There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio...
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Joe Gum is with us. He's the author of 150 Secrets to a Happy Wife. He's an award-winning author and has been featured in the Chicago Sun-Times, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, MSN.com, Parents Magazine, and has been regionally on NBC, Fox, ABC. Joe's an experienced sports broadcaster who worked as a reporter anchor at ESPN for 8 years. He's also worked for as a public address announcer for the NBC Dallas Mavericks, Major League Soccer, and NASCAR, and a whole heck of a lot more. Hey, Joe Gum, welcome to the show.
Hey, how we doing, Michael?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Once I get through the intro, we'll sail smoothly.
Yeah, you bet. And actually, let me go back and say it's. I think I'm going to add 151 because I got approached about 2 weeks ago at church, and the lady said, and she just came up and didn't say hi or anything. She said, "You should have added shave your back," and I had absolutely no idea what she was talking about. And I said, "Huh?" And she said, "You should have put in your book an idea for husbands to shave their back. I wish just once I could hug my husband of 33 years and not feel like I'm hugging a bear." And I just started laughing, and I thought, okay, that'll go in volume two then. Thank you for that advice. And we just kind of laughed it off. But I realized that that was very important to her, and I thought, well, maybe next time it'll go in volume two.
Joe, what was it that caused you to get into this in the first place? Where did that light bulb come on and say, I've got to do this, I've got to research this, I've got to write a book?
Well, my mother-in-law, one night at dinner, said, do you want to continue to breathe, or do you want to meet your maker? And I said, well, I like living, so I'm going to choose living over dying, because what happened 5 minutes before that, my wife was 6 months pregnant, and she and my mother-in-law were in the bedroom right before we ate dinner, the children's bedroom, getting that ready for the baby, and they were talking about paint color, and she'd been talking about paint color all day. Well, I had my fill of it. So we were eating steak that night, I remember, because the knives were out, very sharp, and I said, you know, this isn't all about you. Meaning, it's also about the baby. When my wife stresses, the baby gets it. Of course, that's what I heard. I wasn't sure. So she just broke down, and my mother-in-law gave me this look like, you know, I'm the worst person on the planet. Well, three months go by. We have the baby at home with a midwife, no drugs for my wife. She's not making a peep. And after it was all said and done, my mother-in-law was sort of joking, and she said, you ought to write your next book on how great women are, especially when they have babies. And I thought, you know what, you're probably right. You know, I cry when I lose the remote, but my wife was in there just an hour before having a baby, pushing something the size of a basketball out of something the size of a golf ball, didn't make a peep. Plus, she does about 50 things a day that contribute to our family, and I thought, yeah, you're probably right. So I solicited ideas from women and men, and I got about 500 of them. So we compressed it to 150, and these are what they came out to be.
Now, by the way, with an overarching theme of the 150 secrets to a happy wife, let me ask that question another way. Was it women and men both that you interviewed, or just the husbands?
When the women found out I was writing this book, they were ecstatic. I mean, they just went nuts. Here's a list. I mean, they were bringing me lists. Put this in there. The men, I would ask them, What do you do that's special to your wife? Not a big thing. Don't, excluding jewelry, furniture, a trip to Aruba, you know, a new car, a new house. Those are the big ones. Give me a small one. Give me something that makes her happy on a daily basis. And they threw these ideas out. I mean, literally, working at ESPN, working at Fox Sports, working at these places, some of these men came through and said, oh, she loves it when I take my shoes off after we have our carpets cleaned. And I thought, you know what? I never thought about that. One guy in there said, she loves it when I help her make our bed and we got to put 20 pillows on. And, of course, I understood that because I thought, I'll never understand why we're putting so many pillows on here. And but you know what? It makes her happy. So we do it.
Well, let me ask you this. I think this is an important question. When you got it together, you got the 150 secrets, going through the process, doing all of the interviews, how did that change your own relationship?
Oh, 180. I mean, literally. Because at that point, I hadn't done that many. When I wrote that book, it had been, I think, 8 years we'd been married. And it doesn't take 8 years to know, hey, I'm married. We got things going on here. You know, this is going to either be fun or it's going to be not so fun. And this is how it changed me, Michael. My wife wasn't number one in my life. So she'd become number two or number three because of sports and working on the weekends and different things like that. And that was the mistake. And that's what I tell young men now when I hand them this book and I give them a free copy. I said, you want to have a great marriage, excluding your faith and whatever, you better make your wife number one in your life. If she becomes number two, number three, number four, it's over. Now, a lot of people are still married after 30, 40, 50 years. It's over. They're just living together. They're just kind of getting by and settling. But I didn't make my wife number one anymore, and that's when I realized, man, I don't do this. I don't do this idea. I've never done this idea. Wipe plate off of food after she has slaved over dinner and made the table, and, you know, she did her duty, and I eat, and I can't walk 3 feet to the sink and wipe the food off the table. I mean, I did that one time, or I didn't do it. And Michael, it was like Armageddon in our house. I mean, that was a big deal to her. And after a while, you'll understand when you don't do these things, and every day it's, honey, please, will you fix that thing, that faucet, please, and you don't do it. Honey, please take your shoes off when you come in. I just cleaned the carpets. Honey, please, you know, I'd like to watch a movie on Lifetime tonight. And it's like all these things, it wears down on you. And I know that because I asked my two sisters who have five divorces between them, and they said it was the little things that built up to the big thing.
Joe, you know what I think you ought to do? I'm listening very closely to you. I've got the book in my hand, and I think it's a great book. But take it a step farther. We have a society, we have a culture today that there's about 50-55% of divorces happen within the first year of marriage. Most of that is because they don't know how to treat each other. They don't know how to interact with each other. Just because you fall in love does not mean you know how to be in a relationship. I really believe you should do classes.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. You know, and one of the ideas, Michael, in the book, have a conversation. You know, and not have a conversation with the kids around. And not have a conversation when you take her to the sports restaurant that has 37 TVs. Have a conversation. Look in her eye. Because someone said, oh, is it sex? Is it holding her in love? Literally, my wife, it'll make her day in the morning if I hug her for 30 seconds. Touching her. When you go out, when you're walking around the mall or on the beach, hold her hand. Women absolutely go gaga over that. Because here's the thing, Michael. My wife could have a crazy week, and I bring home a piece of jewelry. She'll probably cry about it because it's a sweet gesture. Probably call one of her friends, maybe her mom, and put it on the shelf or put it on and then get back to her stress for a week. So the little things, those are things that matter. The big things are great.
Yeah, but how many people know that? And I really say that in all sincerity. Just the small things like that. You meet somebody, you fall in love, you get into a relationship, and there's no training on how to be in a relationship. And what an interesting thing. This is like all of the fall downs and get back up and move forwards that you can possibly get. Because if you have 500 secrets and they're taught in a class, and I am dead serious about this, if somebody's going to get married, somebody can get into a relationship, save your marriage. Come to the 150 Secrets to a Happy Wife class, and I'll bet any amount of money the place would be mobbed.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, but you're exactly right. And people say, well, is this for Bubba, the guy who's been married for 35 years? Well, Bubba probably needs it because I joke about putting a marine varnish on the cover of the book So when your wife throws that knife at you, the marine varnish will protect you, protect the book being sliced open. But maybe while you have the book up and she's throwing something, you'll grab an idea out in the air. It's a romance reference guide. And so when we do something stupid, when we say something idiotic, like in the last chapter, you know, 10 things you say if you want to die immediately. When you do those things, you can turn to the book, and hopefully having the book, you won't make those mistakes. Because you're literally saying, here, young 21-year-old man, I'm 38. Take my advice. If you don't help her do this, this, and this, you're going to screw up. You're going to mess up. You know, it's the little things. Read this book. Don't just have it around. When you're on the toilet, by the way, the toilet that you don't flush and don't close the toilet seat, the thing that she hates, when you're on that, read a couple of chapters.
Yeah, now, by the way, I completely agree with you. You get no argument from this side. But I really think it's key. And you know where this should start? It should start probably in the high schools. Not when you're out on the street, not when you're out there doing it. Let it happen beforehand. Why have to make the mistakes if there's, quote-unquote, Joe, a reference guide not to do it?
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And it's like if your wife has become number two, number three, number four over the years, get the book and go through it and say, man, my father-in-law is 63 years old. He's been a CPA with his own firm for 38 years. And he was telling me what CPAs have to go through now and what they've had to go through forever. But they have to take tests every 3 months and get the tax code and all. Everything's changing every day. And I thought, you know, we put so much effort. How many guys sat down during March Madness and it spent hours on finding out which team is going to fail or win the big one? How many guys did? Millions of guys did that in the U.S. How many times do we sit down and we tell our wives, hey, I love you, or we open a book and do research? And it's so funny. We take our marriages for granted, and that's why we have that high divorce rate. In this country, you're absolutely right. You nailed it. We're cynical about marriage. We're cynical about divorce. You know, and people always ask me, the first interview I had was Chicago Sun-Times, and the guy kept pressing me 10 minutes into the interview. Are you whipped? Do you think you're whipped? Do your friends find that you're whipped? And I said, no, I'm not. And I don't cuss, but I felt like cussing him. I felt like saying, heaven, yes, hell, no, they don't think I'm whipped. And you know why? Because I didn't become the mama's boy, or I didn't start my marriage off as the mama's boy going into the marriage, thinking, hey, I'm going to be the king of the castle, and she's going to serve me. I went into it knowing a few things, thanks to my great dad. But you go into that saying, okay, we go into marriage, we're the mama's boy, we're going to get divorced. I see a lot of guys who do that. They're the ones that are whipped because they took the easy way out. The easy way out is calling it quits and giving up and saying, nope, I'm done, and not having to be that man anymore. And there's a chapter in the book called, hey, you want to be the man? Or you say you're the man, be the man. You sat there in front of God, in front of a pastor, a priest, a judge in Vegas, on the beach, in front of friends. You sat there and gave up your vows and said, I'm going to do this, 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 and this. Well, why don't you do it and quit acting like you're going to do it? You know, who cares about that 2 extra hours at work that you got to do papers? And who cares about that dumb Division III women's softball game against I don't care university and, you know, who gives a heck college? And watch that game. Give it up. Hang out with your wife. Go to the mall with her. Who gives a crud what your friends think about you getting a mani-pedi with your wife? You're not some sensitive little sugary muffin cake that sits down and watches the Notebook with her. You went and had your nails done with your wife. Did that make her happy? Yes.
But here's the difference, Joe. I think in essence, I'm listening to you underneath the words. In essence, I think here's what the difference is. You get somebody who goes into a relationship and the guy becomes a slave. All right, he becomes a slave and he's doing all these things because he's afraid he's going to lose her. What if you went into the relationship knowing that you were in absolute control and it's your choice to do these things and you're doing it? It's not that you're being controlled. You're choosing to be like this. There's a whole different level of strength behind it.
100%. You're exactly right. You should have actually given me the forward. You know, it's funny because I was on the other day with a female host on some show, and she said, so what you're doing is you're saying that these should be the women that sit at home and do this, and the man should. And I said, no, that's the opposite of what I'm saying. You, as a man, you should go into marriage thinking, I'm going to be the man, meaning I'm going to be the protector. I'm going to disciple my kids. I'm going to speak truth into my wife, into my kids. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to keep them safe. Women want to feel like they're secured. You know, my wife, when I have issues, or when I used to have issues when I was younger and we just got married and didn't know if I was going to have a job and this and that, you know, that's not secure. Women want to feel secure. And when they know that you're doing your job and working hard and being a man and protecting them and keeping them safe and taking up for them and loving them and being there, they ask you, hey, how do you become a good father? You be a good husband. That's how you become a good father. Your kids are going to watch you, how you treat their wife. And I have four little daughters. So it's really a lot of pressure on me to take care of my wife, to love her, to hold her, to hug her. You know, I love it when I hug my wife and my kids, my 9-year-old walks by and says, ew, gross. Because when she understands why I'm doing that, she's going to appreciate it when her husband does it. And believe me, when guys start courting my daughters, they are going to get a copy of this book. And I may give them 2 or 3 copies and just say, hey, here's 450 ideas. But no, I told the woman, I told the lady on the air, I said, no. I said, we're not creating the housewives of insert city, you know, sitting around. My wife doesn't sit around in a gold lamé sport outfit, you know, athletic suit, eating bonbons, getting a massage while she's watching Oprah. Are there some women like that? Yes. But my wife gives 100%, and I give 100%. Not 50, but 100%. Isn't that amazing? How about you, gentlemen, you, sir, going to it, giving 100%, not sitting there saying, well, boy, you better give me some, too, or I'm going to stop doing this. That's where we get off track. We're thinking it's a give and take. It is to some point. But at one point, you're supposed to say, whether she treats me like the devil or not, I'm going to do my part. And all of a sudden, you have the woman going, well, wait a second. I'm going to do my part, too. Well, good for you. Then you guys need to go out and have seminars and write books, because you're doing exactly what we should be doing.
Joe, let's take it a step farther. Let's take it to another dimension. If you do that and it becomes habit is repetition of action, and it becomes a way of life, and that's the way your attitude is, it can't just happen at home. It's going to happen in the workplace. It's going to happen in organizations. It's going to happen in clubs. It's going to happen with your kids. And I really believe that you should have 3 or 4 different offshoots of the book. The 150 Secrets to Getting Along at Work, a derivative of To Keep a Happy Wife. Because realistically, what you're talking about is creating a behavior, and a behavior that just allows people to be who they are, and you give everything you could possibly give. And at the end of the day, when you've done it, you've not only done it for them, you've done it for you. You can go to sleep with a smile.
You're exactly right, man. You know, I can't do anything if I make my wife happy. I can't sleep. I can't work out. I can't concentrate on the air, because when I'm on TV and I do something, I always have my wife if she's watching me, she'll text me, hey, smile more, sit up straight, your tie's crooked, you know, don't say that word. You know, you're redundant on that word. Don't say that. You know, when you interviewed her, you looked at the camera. So she always helps me. When I get in an argument with her, I really can't do anything, especially an interview about a book that I just wrote about making your wife happy. So you're exactly right. From the standpoint of, hey, it starts at home. You know, it starts with your faith in God or your faith in whatever, and then with your wife. And boy, how about that? How about we have some successful husbands and fathers that are doing their part to be a good husband, to be a good father. And all of a sudden, these great fathers are working in the business, and it's like, boy, you can just tell. And you can tell when someone has it, and they know, hey, that guy's a great guy because of this, this, and this. Well, not because of his education, that helps, but because he's a great father. He's a great husband. Man, he does this. He spends time. There's a balance. And that's really it. We get so busy with so much, pardon my language, but crap. We do so much stuff that really doesn't matter. And I don't think I've heard or seen one guy on his deathbed ever to sit there and say, you know what? Dadgummit, I should have worked more hours. I worked 80 hours a week. I should have worked 100. You know what they say? They say, I should have had more kids. I should have spent more time with my kids. I should have treated my wife better. And we get there on a deathbed at the end, about to meet our maker, thinking, oh, regrets, regrets, regrets. A lot of people are going to regret. And I couldn't even imagine the feeling where I'd have to spend a weekend where I got to go pick up my kids, and my wife is married to another guy because I screwed up and I didn't do the little things that it took.
Hey, Joe Gunn, we're starting to run out of time, but one of the most important takeaways from this, don't get at the end of the line and have to go back and say, I could have, would have, and should have. Do it now. And I think that's really where it is. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, Joe Gum Online, and you can get the book anywhere. I went to a major chain the other day. They had 8 of these books. I went about 5 miles down the street to the same chain. They didn't have one of them. But the good thing is they could order it. So Amazon's out there. Anywhere you want to go to order it, it's all over the place. And let's spread the word, man. Let's get these young guys, because if it doesn't happen, this divorce rate's going to get bigger and bigger, and this country is just going to get ridiculous. And, we're going to have a bunch of divorced single people going out there acting like crazy people, not knowing how to treat their significant others.
And how about more people unemployed because they don't know how to treat a boss? And with that, Joe Gunn, we got to go. Hey, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Michael, I appreciate the time. I really do. Thank you, and thank you to your audience.
Good night.
Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. The new book, Tiger Mother, Son of a Bitch, and as a matter of fact, it's one of those books that you have to really get into and you'll understand it. Derek Lynn with us is the author, graduated from Freehold High School in New Jersey, attended Rutgers University before dropping out due to lack of money for tuition. Now, in the following 3 years, he held a minimum wage job at Dunkin' Donuts, dressed as the Statue of Liberty, waved at passerbys for the Liberty Tax Service, even been a Burger King cashier, worked as a telemarketer, and as assistant hotel manager. He's now planning a writing career. The name of the book, again, is Tiger Mother, Son of a Bitch. And let's say, Derek, a welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Now, the name of the book in and of itself, obviously, it's got a meaning beyond what it just sounds like. Where was it? What was it that drove you? What was your mom like? What caused this title?
Well, basically, the title, I wrote this book in response to Amy Chua's Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. I wanted to tell the story from the perspective of a child rather than a tiger mother's perspective, because I feel that they can damage children and their mental health.
You know, by the way, when we really look at it in about driving your children, there is a point where the drive is too much and it actually stops the progression of the child. And so, and it's very hard for a mother to know where that spot is, where they have to stop, where the damage is going to start.
Oh, yes, I agree wholeheartedly with that. But in the case of my mother, it was her vanity that she, even if she knew where to stop, she wouldn't stop. She's just because her upbringing on me would reflect on her. It's what all she would care about. She's like Joan Crawford.
Yeah. Now, by the way, this is from the press release. I was abused, tortured as a child up until adulthood when I finally was able to break free of my oppressive mother. As a Chinese American, I'm supposed to be highly successful, so my mother forced me to do things no other child my age would do. Driven to learn the violin, piano, trumpet, drums, practice for hours. Now, how does that affect a child's mind?
Well, they're basically at the mercy of their parents, so all they know how to do if a parent teaches them to do that is just to rote memorize and to take orders. It doesn't really allow for much creative thinking, I think.
Hmm. Now, is your mom still with us? Is she alive?
You mean, is she still alive? Well, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, okay. How did she deal with the book when it finally came out? How did she handle it? Have you talked to her? Have you heard anything? Have you gotten feedback?
No, I don't talk to her at all, and I don't care to as a result of her parenting. I resent her highly for that.
Does she understand what she did?
I think she does, but her vanity and self-image and greed and all that, it overshadows that. So it doesn't really matter to her, I think.
All right, let's try this out. I want to look at it from a different perspective because I've never asked this question before. Chinese mothers, is that an average Chinese mother? Is that the mindset of the mother to drive the child that way?
Well, it would be biased of me to speak for all Chinese mothers, but for the most part, Chinese mothers, they have a sort of a sense of a Confucian value to teach their children to study and work hard, and they say it's part of Chinese society, but I think it's not the case. It's like propaganda. They're just using it to serve their own purpose, to be able to control their children better.
Okay, now there have been mothers, you know, and I've listened to Chinese mothers before that have moved their children in the right direction. They've pushed them beyond what the child thought that they can do, and it turned out okay. But there's got to be, and I'm gonna go back to where I was initially with this. There's got to be that line in the sand that you draw to know when you're going too far. And you have to define what children are, what they mean to you, and where you truly want them to be. Are they a possession, rhetorically? Are they a possession, or, Derek, are they human beings? And it sounded like, under this particular situation, you were a possession.
Oh, yes, that is correct. Basically, I was her slave. I had to do all her chores and mine. She said it was for my benefit because it would make me a better person, but I kind of knew it wasn't. I found that out very early on.
Okay, what do we get out of the book, the takeaway? You know, I pick up the book, I read it page by page, cover to cover. Derek, what's inside that book for everybody? What is that message that people should hear?
Well, the message is that people under a travesty of justice or oppression, they should learn how to cope with it and realize it's not their fault. It's something that they can't control, and that they should try to overcome it in any way, form as possible.
Now, by the way, do you have brothers and sisters, or were you an only child?
Oh, no, I'm an only child.
So do you think it might have been different if you would have had brothers and sisters, or do you think it would have been the same thing for all the kids?
I think it would have been the same thing for all the children because, my parents are now divorced. My father is living in Taiwan, but before they were divorced, my mother would emphasize and shift all the burden onto him. And after the divorce, she started to ladle the pressure on me more, I've realized. So it would have been the same, though I think a brother or sister might have been able to deflect some of it and share the pain and suffering. So maybe.
In all of your experiences, now I know this is your first book and now you want to be a writer, is there that much inside of you that needs to come out? And when I say that, every author that I've ever known, and I've known many in my time, that whatever they're writing about, now this is specifically about you, but even if it's a fiction novel, if it's a whatever, it's their way of expressing and get that those things that are inside internally, outside and in front of them. So this must have been in some way, shape, or form, this particular book for you. When you finished it, this had to be a letting go of something. It had to be some kind of a feeling of freedom.
Yes, it was somewhat a bit of freedom because I don't usually talk about this. I'm not a very talkative person in general. because if I feel that if I were to talk about my life, people wouldn't understand me because it would just be hearsay. But now that this book is in written form, they can read every little detail that they need to know to form a unbiased opinion. So yes, it does get much off my chest.
Now, when we take a look at that and we see parents raising children today, was there anything that anybody could have done to make your mother look at life differently and the relationship could have been different? Or that's the way it was, that's the way it would be if you started all over again, and there's nothing that would have changed it?
Yes, I will go with your the latter one. That's there's no way to change her. She's, in fact, still like that right now, which is why I don't talk to her.
Now, how long has she been here? Is she totally into this culture now, or is there still a lot of China in her?
I think she's been here for 31 years since 1980, so I don't think that's an issue there. This is not so much, my book is not so much about a cultural thing. It explores how just certain people behave.
Oh, and I understand when I'm talking cultural thing, there's got to be something that drives someone like that. Normally, we model after what we've been taught from our parents. You know, our parents learned from their parents who learned from their parents. So it had to be something that came down the line that was within her that caused the problems with you. And is her family like that, or was it just her personality?
Now that you mention it, her family is like that. They're all, in my opinion, they are vain and selfish. So basically, I guess they passed that on to her quite well.
Now, who do you want to read this book? Is it for the moms or for the kids? Who is your target for this book?
It's for everyone, for the children, so that they could provide them a source of inspiration, how to cope, and the fact that they're not alone, and especially for the parents. I want them to read, too, because all this forcing and over-demanding can be counterintuitive in the end. And if you see my case here, I turned out I'm not going to Harvard or Yale. I'm trying to go get another fast food job.
Okay, but by the way, if she would have been different, do you think life would be different for you? What is it that stops you from finding the Harvard, finding the Yale, finding that whatever it is that's beyond the fast food?
Basically because she forced it upon me. I mean, I'll make an example. Basically, ice cream. Children like ice cream. It tastes great. But how my mother gave it to me, she'd force it into my face and shoved it down my throat and force-fed it to me. So I don't actually hate the ice cream. I just don't like the fact that she forced me. And it just doesn't give me motivation to do it because I just have such a repression, some mindset that it relates back to the trauma I endured. So.
By the way, how would that affect it? Are you married? Or are you in a relationship?
No, I'm not, but I was in a relationship.
How was that relationship? Did you feel any of your mother coming out through you? Because a lot of that happens so many times.
Well, I tried. I don't think I had this engendered. She engendered in me the same characteristics of her overbearing, controlling, demanding attitude, but. The relationship didn't go so well because I just lacked so many of the things that she never allowed me to learn. And I drove that girl away, unfortunately, as I explain in the book.
And by the way, it's never, I know what this sounds like, it sounds so cliche, but it's not cliche. It's really never too late. Sometimes you have to just sit down, take a deep breath and say, what is it that I want out of life, and go for it. And no matter how tough it is at the moment, you know, the value for going after and getting it, it's greater than anything you could possibly buy. You can't even put a dollar amount on it. And the book can be one of the greatest things that you've ever done because, in essence, no matter what else you write, this could end up, Derek, this could end up being your legacy.
Yeah, actually, that's what I felt as well. So I'm proud that I wrote this book.
Now, by the way, what's next on the agenda?
Well, I have a couple more. I've always been writing, got a couple of story ideas here and there, but basically I just want to see how people look at my writing style from this book, so see if they're receptive to it.
Yeah, but the writing style is this. But then the next topic, and I think would be a great book. The name of the next book would be After Mom, and what life is like afterwards, after the first book, and then the finding somehow of letting go of all those, you got to call them change, the things that lock you up, the things that hold you back, and it's the letting go of those things that that really what life is about. But most of us wait too long to let it happen. We get too old for it to happen, and then we turn around and look and it's too late. You sound like you're young, and you sound like you've got everything ahead of you, and you have right. The ability to do it, and it's called, you know, kick a little posterior and make life happen for you.
Oh, that's what I'm trying to do right now.
Okay, now, by the way, the book in and of itself, where can we find it at?
On the website tigermothersob.com. Or alternatively, it's downloadable as an ebook from Amazon Kindle.
Wonderful. Okay, we're starting to run out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I really appreciate your time. And there is a message in the book, and I hope a lot of people get it and take a look.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And the name of the book is Pope Annalisa Peter Canova with us from the time he first experienced phenomena such as telepathy, remote viewing, intuitive medical readings, and psychic healing. Peter spent much of his time in his life seeking to understand the forces, and listen to this very closely, the forces that link humanity together on an unseen level. He's distilled his experiences with the publication of the novel Pope Annalisa, and which immediately won 3 Nautilus Awards, the Independent Publishers Award, and the National Best Book Award in quick succession. And in Pope Annalisa, he explores an ancient spiritual tradition which cut across not only Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also the so-called pagan mystery schools of ancient days. Peter, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's nice to be back with you again.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Peter, when we look at spirituality, there are so many people who get confused. And I say the word confused, we're told to think this way, we're told to feel that way. And sometimes we just, that deep inner voice that we have, that intuitive voice that really tells us what's good or bad for us, gets buried. And I think when we deal with spirituality and that unseen link, I think it's that voice that most of us bury.
Well, yes, it's true, and I spent a great deal of my life trying to understand the issues that you just spoke to. I've done it through my own, you know, personal journey, my own personal meditations, which had their reflections in the outer world, and I think that's the only way by which you can sort of, you know, validate subjective experiences is if they do you some practical good in the outer world. So I spent much of my time sort of trying to trace down our whole spiritual foundation, which differs from religion in the sense that the ancient universal spiritual tradition, which I kind of uncovered during the course of my studies, is really more of not a credo or a set of guidelines that you have to follow, strict rules and regulations as you find in the Catholic Church, for instance, but really more like guideposts or signposts to help you on your own spiritual journey.
Now, by the way, years ago, Peter, probably had to be 35, 40 years ago now, I was on the beach in the Los Angeles area. I was on the beach, and it was nighttime, and it was a gorgeous night. And I remember I was laying in the sand and looking up at the stars, and there had to be 1.5 million stars out there. It was one of those nights that was absolutely breathtaking. And I looked up at the stars, and my mind started going, and I started to think, what's beyond that? And then I thought, well, how can there be anything beyond that? And then I thought, well, it's got to have an end. But then I thought, how can anything end? And what's beyond the beyond? And I actually got scared. It got me to a point. It went beyond my linear thinking. And it brought me into a realm a while later to get me to think that it's undefinable. And if people start to define the undefinable, for the most part, that tells me they have no idea what they're talking about, because there's things out there, and I'm not talking about you and what you've discovered, but when there are certain people that say God is this way, this is that way, religion is this way, it's defining the undefinable, and that's where I think the problem is. And the undefinable, I think, is the link between all of us, all of humanity, all of spirituality, that pure essence of something that lies underneath the surface.
If you understand God as the supreme consciousness and everything below that level as degrees of consciousness, there certainly is a point where life and the infinite is a mystery, that things that we probably will never know. What we can know, however, what we can trace is the footsteps leading in that direction. And I think that's what much of my work speaks to.
What did you find?
Well, what I found was that there was a universal spiritual tradition that was kept alive by the mystery schools in ancient days. Now, these mystery schools, think of them almost like the Ivy League of today. They were a collection of ancient learning academies stretching from the Vedic schools in India to the Druid practices in the British Isles. And like the Ivy Leagues, they had stringent admission requirements for those who were intelligent and spiritually mature enough to receive their teachings. So they would study such topics as mathematics, philosophy, harmonics, and astrology. But this was all really preparatory material to receive transmission of a sacred mystical tradition that really went back into the mists of time. And, you know, this universal spiritual tradition, I might outline it quickly because I think it's going to be very important to an understanding of everything we're talking about tonight. It was different. It differed somewhat in different cultures, but it had a core commonality to it, an essential core that was the same for every land that you would go into. And it essentially said that one single energy underlies all reality and dimensions of existence. And this energy is called thought, which was the ancient term for consciousness. And light is the medium through which this consciousness expressed itself. So light, in the view of the ancients, carried the directive information that organized matter and creation. And this consciousness, or this light, divided and projected itself outward to form numerous points of consciousness. And the real interesting thing happens here. As the consciousness projected itself out from its center, it experienced increasing degrees of ignorance or forgetfulness about its source. This would be similar to making copies of a DVD. You have the original, then you make a copy of that and a copy of that. But with each successive copy, you lose some clarity and resolution. This whole principle of forgetting or ignorance of its own source was a necessity for the ultimate consciousness to forget its own wholeness. And this was the only way the whole could begin to think of itself as parts, thus creating the illusion of a separate identity. How can the everything think of itself as the something except through an act of forgetting or an illusion? So the Hindus always used to say that this world is the playground in which God forgets himself. But it was the joint action of this whole and its parts that led to the creation of the material universe and the human being. And that's the one important idea to remember, because now we can get into a whole fascinating realm of what quantum physics is now saying about some of these same subjects that the ancients tackled thousands of years ago.
And the most important something in the world is nothing. And I really believe that that's where we have a problem from, you know, whether it be politics, whether it be culture, some kind of a misunderstanding of definition that causes people to have problems. It's coming from a place of nothing. And because if you come from a place of something, you're just adding old stuff to it. And I really believe that if you just get yourself centered, get yourself quiet, there are all of the problems that you possibly have you're going to find answers for. But most people won't do that, Peter. They just move and they go and they grab onto something that feels like it's going to be a solution to a problem. And for the most part, it's not a solution to a problem. They're not just letting it happen. And I think it's a base. I don't even think the word understanding works, because if we get into something provable, which is science, the universe goes way beyond that. Spirituality goes way beyond that. The biggest problem that people have today is, and I'm not a I don't have expertise in the Bible, but I do know that when it was originally created, the language of the cultures at the time were symbolic. They had to be symbolic. They had to be a metaphor to hide what it was. Otherwise, they would have been killed. And I think the big problem people have today, and you're talking, excuse me, about the delusion, is when they interpret today, they interpret literally, and it wasn't written literally. And that's that delusion. And that's what hides what's really meant by what people thought and what people said at the time.
Well, it's absolutely true, many of the things that you said in terms of the different type of language that was used in the Bible. I mean, there were a couple things in play here. First of all, they didn't have the technological terms that modern science uses, so we have to take into account, you know, the culture and the state of technology at the time. And the other thing you're completely correct about is that, yes, they wrote in symbols and allegories, and they were basically leading towards archetypes, which were what they felt were the underlying templates that form the true reality that this world is a reflection of. Now, the interesting thing is that what I have found is this. I tend to think that absolute truth is something that we in this dimension probably can never really grasp. You know, every time I think of something, you know, I've really grasped onto something as a truth, a month later I seem to have a new truth that supersedes it. But what I really have found is that in studying the ancient spiritual texts, there are points of intersection between what these ancient spiritual traditions were saying and what we're describing on the frontiers of modern quantum physics, which is the branch of science that really probes into the underlying nature of our reality. And there's these amazing intersections of what the ancients were saying a couple thousand years ago and what quantum physics is saying today. And what I call that the axis of truth, because I think that when you have the objective side, which is science, and the subjective side, which is spiritual mysticism, coming together at these points, essentially saying the same thing, that is probably the closest that we can come to sort of defining truth in this world.
Okay, now when you wrote the book, and the purpose of the book, you created Pope Annalisa. Now here we have someone who's female as a pope, which we know basically may never happen. But the key is, why? What was the symbology behind her being the pope?
Well, for one thing, the ancients had a vision of the deity as having two faces. There was God the Father and God the Mother. There was the unknowable, and the unknowable manifested itself into the Godhead, which is the closest thing that we can come to positing what the, you know, what the supreme being is about. And it had two faces, the male and the female face. It was over a period of time that the female was more and more forgotten, and yet the female is really the gateway that leads to our experience of higher consciousness, because it was the female side of the equation, just as in the right brain and left brain theory that we have of, you know, how the right brain is intuitive and embodies the feeling nature, the left brain is rational and involves the analytic nature, that it was really this intuitive nature, according to the ancients, that led to the creation itself. And it was the employing as human beings this intuitive nature that is going to sort of open the gateway to get us back into a contact with this higher consciousness. So I wanted to really emphasize this, and this was one of several points, but this was probably major one of the major reasons that I wanted to make that figure in the book the leading figure, a female character.
Those things that you've experienced in your own life that you've put into the book, the telepathy, the remote viewing, and things of that nature, The average person, Peter, it's very hard for the average person to grasp what it is that you talk about because they haven't experienced it. And for the most part, what it does, it scares people. People are frightened of, quote unquote, the unknown. There's that old adage, rather unhappy than unsure. And it scares them and it pushes them away. But you've experienced some of these things. And in those things that you've experienced, what has it brought you to? Where are you today after you've experienced what you've experienced? What is it that we are lacking to become a peaceful planet? And this is really what it's about, the definition of what peace is, the definition of humanity, because there's so many different thoughts of, you know, who should be and who should die. Where do we go? What do we use? What tools do we use to come to that meeting of the minds, that meeting of humanity, that meeting of spirituality, whereby we'll accept each other as a presence?
Well, I think the first thing is that we're talking a little bit here about the difference between faith and knowledge. And even those people who are, let's say, a very fundamental persuasions, who are the ones that would be most likely to reject things spiritual that are outside of the scope of certain creeds and scriptures, understand the idea of faith. Faith is basically making a propositional belief of truth in something that you haven't had direct knowledge of. And we do that all the time. For most people, belief in the scriptures is an act of faith because they haven't experienced some of the things or the miracles that went on in the scriptures. So they take that as an act of faith. And I think it's not too it's not demanding too much of people to say, look, there's nothing wrong with a belief in the scriptures as the way they are. But take a look at it like this: if you are at the foot of the mountain and you're looking into the valley, you're going to see so much. It doesn't mean that what you see is wrong. It just means that you're getting a limited view of what's in the valley. But if you take a more expansive view of scripture and the Bible and of spirituality, and you move a little higher up the mountain, you get a broader view of the valley below and what's happening there. So it's not a question of is somebody right or is somebody wrong. It's really more a question of a viewpoint. It's really more a question of how much do you want to limit your viewpoint, how much do you want to allow for the operation of other things that could be going on, and take these things provisionally on faith until you can prove them out yourself. I think that, number one, having a flexible mind like that is the first step towards having higher realizations and allowing yourself to be open to other forms of guidance and so forth. There's also a certain amount of work involved in it. There's meditation, reflection and things. But I think, Michael, it really comes from a heartfelt desire to say, you know what, I'm not going to be so arrogant as to think that I or any scripture contains all the truth. I'm going to allow for the fact that there's other things out there to grow and to learn, and I'm going to leave myself open to that, and I'm going to study, and I'm going to reflect, and I'm going to meditate. It takes that desire, and it takes that work to initially open up the gates. I do believe that people that engage in that course of action eventually can have a direct contact with a higher intelligence that I have had, that numerous other people have had. And once you do have that contact with higher intelligence and you see the operation of it in what we call the, quote, real world, unquote, that it's not just a figment of your imagination, but it has real world corollaries, then you've moved from faith to knowledge. This is your own. You own this now. You know these things exist for a fact because you've experienced them.
Okay, when we're dealing with this and somebody can experience it, I think the biggest problem that most people have is that, and I'm going to go back, let's say, to science, something provable. If I can put my hands around, not I, Michael, but if I can put my hands around it and I realize that I've got a control and a grasp of it, then I'm fine. That's the average human being. But if you look at the universe and the universes within the universes and the billions of planets out there, there's got to be that time where you have to sit back and look in the mirror and say, maybe there's more to what I've been taught. And I think that's the opening of the door to the understanding of what's out there. When I say understanding, just the base understanding that there is something out there. And with all the experience, Peter, that you've had, no matter how much you've had, there's going to be more. And we all know that there's going to be more. So what I'm hearing you say, and please stop me if I'm wrong, I don't want to speak for you, that there's a possibility that there's much more out there than you think is out there. And if you just allow yourself to look, you're going to see things you didn't know that you could possibly see.
That's exactly what I'm saying, and also what I'm saying is, in terms of my own experience, that I'm not claiming to be an enlightened person. I'm claiming to be a person who has had glimpses of enlightenment, and I think that's a more humble position to take about what I've experienced, because there always is more to learn. I've even in my own life, where some people think, wow, you know, you've really kind of advanced along the way if you've had those experiences. Well, I feel like I'm a baby. I feel like I'm just scratched the surface. I'm learning so much more every day, and you know, growing and having to sort of set things aside that I may have thought were, you know, somewhat set in stone before. One thing I try very hard to guard against is forming orthodox opinions of any single thing. If I see something that really looks like a truth to me, I try and take it on a provisional basis, you know, and really kind of test it out and in my own experience until I'm satisfied that that can occupy the status of a belief or a truth to me. But it's that flexibility of mind that I think we have to keep in order to grow, so we don't just punch our ticket and stay in one building and box ourselves in.
Sure, and there's that old saying that thinking outside the box. There's so many people who think the same thoughts. You mix them up a little bit and they come out a little different, but they're usually all the same thoughts. Thinking outside the box, the true definition of that is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And if somebody will just step outside for a moment, there is a completely different world that will open up to you. Do I know what it is? Of course not. But at the same time, I do know that there's existence of something more than we think that there is. And when you begin to touch on it through the mystery schools and the Gnostics and I mean, it goes on in quantum physics. If you move into that, you don't have to know it all, but you just have to know enough that some way, some shape, some form, we are all interconnected. There is a vast consciousness out there, and if anybody wants to prove it out, you can have answers to anything you want if you just allow yourself to accept it.
Well, you know, you can look at Einstein. You know, everybody's familiar with Einstein's famous equation, E equals MC squared. A lot of people don't really understand what that really means. But essentially what Einstein was telling us is that matter and energy, which is light, are interchangeable forms of the same substance. They're intimately connected. They're not two different things, as casual observation, you know, would seem to lead us to. So we've had to revise our notion of reality as being these solid 3D objects extended in space to understand them more in the nature of being interconnected fields of force at varying vibrational rates, which produce varying forms, whether it's more of a pure energy or whether it solidifies into something that we call matter or mass. It's essentially all interconnected in this same field, and by various mechanisms, it's drawn forth from light wave potentials into actual particle or physical reality. And this is essentially what quantum physics is really telling us. Quantum physics says that at a fundamental nature, particles do not exist. Those building blocks that we were always taught that comprise the real world and make us and everything else in it solid don't exist at a fundamental level. What does exist at a fundamental level is waves of light containing all possibilities and outcomes. And it's through the medium of our consciousness, for one thing, that mediates those things into existence as physical realities.
And by the way, to exemplify what you're saying, anybody can look in the mirror, because your physical body, your brain, and your mind are everything that you said. Each one of us is a complete example of what you just talked about. A thought can create something physical. A thought can manifest things. It can manifest a future, an education, a new car if you want it. And everything you just said, we do that day in and day out, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting if you note the brain itself. A lot of people think, well, you know, well, reality and, you know, the brain is really like everything here if you take a materialist point of view. The brain is encased in total darkness. Objects that we see, that we perceive as being external to ourselves, don't exist externally. They exist as a picture in a certain area of the brain, towards the back of the brain, yet the brain is encased in total darkness. The brain does not see directly. There's a whole mathematical transmission between the optical nerves of the eyes and where the actual image is seen in the brain. And the fascinating thing is science is now leading us to believe, and I the source of this is very, very difficult to explain. It gets into what they've observed about black holes, but science is really starting to believe that what we call physical reality is actually almost like projections that are coming from a higher dimension of a template of objects, forms, or blueprints that are coming from a higher dimension and are projected onto our world in the form of a three-dimensional illusion that operates very much like a hologram. Now, that's not science fiction. It sounds like Star Trek and the holodeck, but this is what some of the leading and cutting-edge physicists are saying is the real underlying nature of our reality today. It's like a holographic movie projection.
And by the way, this is coming more and more to the fore, and I believe very sincerely that if you and I and four or five other people look at something, that mathematical equation you were talking about is going to be different in everybody, because we're all going to see it differently based on our experience and based on where it comes from the rear of the brain. By the time it gets from the eyes to the brain, to the rear of the brain, and how it comes out is based on your experience. So your equation, your mathematical equation, is going to differ from person to person to person.
Yeah, well, there's going to be a certain amount of commonality, and there's going to be a certain amount of difference. The common denominator is what we call consensus reality. It's sort of the basic picture of what we all agree on is, you know, quote, out there, unquote. And the differences you're talking about has really got to do with the nature of personal reality. In terms of our experience, how we interpret these things essentially becomes our belief system, which controls how we see the world, which in turn controls how we experience much of the world. So that old New Age adage, and I'm not really big on a lot of New Age things, but there are some truisms there that, you know, you sort of are what you think and so forth comes into play there.
No question about that. By the way, I think that adage in and of itself is one of the most powerful things that anybody can take a look at about themselves. You think you're a loser, you're a loser. You think you're a winner, and it goes from there. It's because that mind you just talked about will do everything that it can to prove yourself right about yourself. It's a mechanism, and you got to learn how to use it. Peter Canova, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a very interesting thing at operation here, Michael, and you know, getting back to this holographic universe. A hologram basically happens when you take one source of light and you split it, and one beam reflects on a subject, let's call it an apple, and then the original beam loops around and commingles with the reflected light off that first beam, almost like if you throw two stones side by side in the water and you see their waves ripple together. So the two beams of light reconverge, and the commingled waves of light form this 3D holographic image. And that is how they're saying that that's basically a perfect description of what the ancients said, how the world was created, that the one source of light, which is God, divided itself up into different points of consciousness, which is little with a little c, that's you, me, and you know, everything with consciousness in it, and that first beam hits us, which is the small consciousness, and then the reflected light off us loops back and mingles with that original source of light, and we co-create the image of the 3D universe together with the creator. This is the basis of co-creation, and it's a holographic principle, and it's exactly what the ancients were describing as how the world was formed, and it's exactly what the hologram theory is saying today. So we are co-creators in this sense with a scientific background to it.
So we had to come thousands of years just to find out that what we originally thought, and I have to say we, because we're all part of the humanity, to find out that what we thought thousands of years ago, we're just starting to discover again.
And that's because we went astray at some point, especially in the Western world, and we started looking at things outside of ourselves. We started to believe that there was more truth in instruments and more truth in mathematical formulas than there was inside ourselves. Now, that's not to say that you can't discover truth by scientific means. You certainly can. It's very valid and it's very valuable. But you can discover just as much, if not more, by an internal investigation of your own consciousness. Because if, in fact, we are holograms, you know, one of the famous properties of a hologram is it contains, each part of a hologram contains the image of the whole inside itself. And this is what the ancients told us, that we are sparks of God. We are the projections of God's essence in material form, and we contain the whole within us. By tracing back the source of our consciousness or light, we then reflect back into the hologram process, and we start to see the nature of reality from which it came. And that's how the ancients got the jump on quantum physics 2,000 and 3,000 years ago.
But Peter, we're out of time. I could talk to you all night about this. Website we can find you at.
Yeah, my website is called popeannalisa.com. That's popeannalisa.com. The book is available. If you can order it through your bookstore, or you can get it online through Amazon.com, Borders, Barnes & Noble, any of the online bookstores. And I will be speaking, I just want to mention, on April 30th up in San Francisco at the New Life Expo over there for anybody that's going to be in the Bay Area.
Wonderful. Hey, Peter Canova, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm glad you came back.
Nice to be with you, Michael. Take care.
Take care. Good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me?
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And remember these words. Take it back now.
Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona, show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
He is back, Mayor Eisenstein, Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, and he is the author of Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate. And we're going to have a good 10 minutes with him. And Mayor High, welcome back.
Oh, Michael, and happy Pesach to you and a happy to all our Christian friends.
Yeah, and it, by the way, the Radio Susie's new title is, what is your new title? What is your new title? What are you hoarding? What are you hoarding? She walks in here with Kugel and doesn't even offer me any. How's that? So she's got new type Kugel hoarder.
Kugel hoarder. I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, you know, I with the holiday season, you know, one of the things that always goes along with the holiday season is wonderful food, well prepared food, very typically food that all of us indulge a little bit too much. And I just want to mention something that about an over-the-counter drug made by GlaxoSmithKline calls Ali, I'm not sure, it's A-L-L-I. And I wrote a little piece called Ali is not Ali cracked up to be what it's supposed to be, because GlaxoSmith is about to sell it because they found not only last year did they find that it caused kidney damage, but now just there's a study that came out showing it caused liver damage. And it's the weight loss of this drug amounted to about 8 or 9 pounds in 1 year. So in exchange for 8 or 9 pounds of weight loss, you are have the possibility of developing kidney damage and liver damage. I find it interesting that the Food and Drug Administration finds this out. And instead of telling them they may have to take the drug off the market, what they do is you have to put a warning on it. Now, what does that mean?
By the way, I don't think it means anything anymore, because you end up, you're watching television, you're watching a commercial, and it says, buy XYZ product. It'll help you feel good. It'll cause you to lose weight. Now, the side effects are coma or death.
Right.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
There's a great little cartoon a couple of years ago talking about that, and they said, and death may be a side effect of this medication.
Don't worry, maybe
a contraindication to taking it, you know, or you know, it's so unbelievable, you know. But I find this nauseating to no end that the FDA that goes after vitamin C and vitamin D is all worried about this, you know, natural products. Does nothing to stop a drug that's outwardly dangerous and doesn't work, you know, and over
well, the midst of the Mayor, let me hold you up for a minute. Because I think this is very important. Who does the testing and the approval for it to come out to the public?
Oh, it's the drug companies themselves.
Absolutely.
There's a rare exception. You know, what happens is then someone See, up until recently, they had a right to do 10 studies, I'm going to use that number 10, on any pharmaceutical, and only publish the one that came out with the positive results. So they may have 9 out of 10 showing that this is dangerous. They had a right not to publish it. But you know, what's happened is little things, now they let more through because they know it doesn't make a difference. Even if they get studies published to show that it's dangerous, it doesn't change anything.
Okay, so effectively, somebody is making money somewhere.
Right.
That's it. And it's at the cost of lives, and that's a problem.
Yeah, you listen to this. The Watch Group, a public citizen, has called for both drugs, that Zenical, that's the prescription form, and Ali, the over-counter, to be banned due to liver injury reports. Galaxo defended its safety in a statement, saying it was safe and effective when used as directed. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's just it. It doesn't mean anything. And the problem that I see constantly, I'll watch an ad. If you use XYZ, it's going to help. It's going to clear your complexion up. Now, 18 months later, you see an attorney's firm get on the same station, the same channel, at the same time, and saying, if you used XYZ, and if any of your family has died, or if you've died, call us, and we'll get retribution, and you'll make a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. You're not kidding. And the other thing is, with the holiday season, you know, I'm going to give one suggestion that all of us know about, but we should think about even more in the benefits of apples. As you know, that apples are an integral part of the Dr. Simeon HCG protocol, which we've adapted and modified slightly for modern use. You know, what does it mean modified it? Because Dr. Simeon, when he did his work on overweight, most people were 15, 20 pounds overweight. They weren't 50, 60, 70, or more than 100 pounds overweight. And there has just been so enormous amounts of studies on the value of apples. But here's a new one. An apple a day may keep the, you know, we all know the expression, apple a day keeps the doctor away. But here we go one step further. An apple a day may keep the cardiologist away. A daily apple consumption appears to help lower cholesterol. According to a study at Florida State University, researchers randomly assigned women to one group and to another group, and they gave them apples. They didn't give them apples. And the one with the apples, all their levels, the good cholesterol went up and the bad cholesterol went down.
I got to tell you something. This is an honest-to-God story, and it happened to me last night about 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sound asleep, and I get up, and I go to that one nice place that you go to in the middle of the night, and I stop by the refrigerator. I said, I'm hungry. And what's sitting there? There's a bag of apples. And, you know, I swear, Mayor, I thought about you when I grabbed the apple.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It's true. Of course, I peeled it. The skin of an apple, what does that hold?
Oh, my God, it's got all the antioxidants. You know, it's got all the toxins also from the sprays. But, you know, it's a wash, what you could do. Maybe that's a good word for it, you know. If the toxins are more dangerous than the antioxidants they get with it and the fiber, you know. I don't peel the apples, you know what I mean? I'll just wash it off, you know, and will it get everything off? Most probably not. But, you know, it's like everything else. You want to eat as much of the natural package as you can, you know. And it's the same thing with grapefruits. I used to think that a grapefruit, you're supposed to cut it in half, cut it up, and then put sugar on it. I never thought of it in terms of like an orange or so that you eat it whole. I mean, take the skin off, you know, but eat it with the pulp and everything. And I've grown accustomed. I love it now, you know. And one more thing about apples and grapefruits, you don't want to drink the juice. Not that the juice is unhealthy, but it takes about 20 minutes for the body to recognize that you've eaten something. And if you drink juice, you can drink a glass of juice down in about 15 or 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds. As opposed to eating an apple takes about 5, 10, or 15 minutes. So by the time you finish eating the apple, the body realizes you've eaten and you won't be hungry anymore. But if you drink the juice, you'll still be hungry for about 15 or 20 minutes, and that may be another place where you start looking for something else to eat.
All right. By the way, that makes sense. What happens if you can't swallow the skin? And that happens to a lot of people. Get
well,
stuck
you
in
know, then you can cut it off. I mean, you know, you don't want to, but you know, or you can slice it into small pieces. Sometimes that'll make a difference, you know. But if you can't swallow the skin, clearly take it off. Clearly, the goal is not to choke to death. You know, but I think that as whole as anything can be, you know, that's what you want to do. And chew slowly and eat slowly. It's something that all of us are in the bad habit of. So even, and you know, Karen, my wife, did something really incredible for the Passover Seders. It was done out of necessity, but it turned out to be really, we usually have 25 or 30 people at our table. She bought a big island for the kitchen, and she put all the food there, and everyone brought their plate to the island and brought their food back to the main table. And I noticed myself, as well as everyone else, ate about 30 or 40% less, not because we were lazy to walk into the kitchen, which is only a few feet away, but if there's no food right in front of you, there's a tendency just to eat what you have on your plate, you know. And so that's, you know, kind of another little suggestion that you should take whatever you need, but not put it right in front of you so you're not tempted, just because the food in everyone's house is just absolutely outstanding, you know. And so you start to eat not because you're hungry, because you like what you have in front of you.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, the magic essence of the diet that you were on, or are on, and that you've lost over 100 pounds with, what is that magic essence? What is that one thing that
you
discovered?
Well, it's called HCG. It's human chorionic gonadotrope, and it's made from women during pregnancy. And we're only now discovering more and more of the reason for pregnancy. It's a protective mechanism. If the woman during pregnancy it doesn't have enough food available, it starts breaking down her fat and using it stored energy. And it seems to have the same beneficial effect in small doses if you're not pregnant. Also, it has the effect of if the woman has back pain, knee pain, all type of pain, of loosening the ligaments, you know, not only to help give birth to the baby, but also to alleviate pain throughout the body, because here you're carrying pregnancy in a certain sense is you put on an enormous amount of weight and carry it all in front, very similar to what so many of us do when we develop a big abdomen, you know. And so it's a protective mechanism, so you're able to carry the baby physically as well. And pain clinics now around the country, many of them are starting to notice that HCG in small quantities could be one of the treatments to lower long-term chronic pain relief as well. So this has become phenomenal rediscovery of something that's been known for a long time.
So to get the HCG, you have to, it's a prescription, so you have to go to your doctor or a doctor that is versed in the use of it, and that's really the key, the secret to weight loss.
Exactly, I without a doubt in my mind, you know. And it's a physician-run program, you know. Or it could be a nurse practitioner who also has prescriptive authority. But it's more than just buying it and doing it. I think it requires visits to the doctor. And the typical doctor, the best doctor you want, I shouldn't put it this way, you know. But clearly, many of the doctors who are working with us, Michael, have lost 10, 15, 20 pounds themselves using it. So they're, you know, but that's not a critical criteria, you know, for it. I know that because in all the years I delivered babies, the best nurses in the world were the nuns who never had any children, but they were incredible midwives, you know. So women, as a man, I never gave birth either, and I helped many, many women give birth, you know. But it needs someone who understands how serious the problem is and how difficult it is. It's not something that someone is just eating because they don't know what to do. I mean, it is a serious, serious problem, overweight. Now, look, I'm still part of it. Thank God, not as much now. But it's something that took me 25 years to find a solution to help me make the lifestyle change that will allow me to weigh substantially less than I did 2 years ago.
So, by the way, Mayor, let me interrupt just for a moment. We're starting to run out of time, but I think it's critically important that people go to your website, and the reason for that is they can see what it is that we're talking about, because to see you before and after is unbelievable. It was how much, 100 and how many pounds now?
115 pounds right now.
115 pounds.
You know,
yeah.
And I'm about 20 pounds overweight right now, but compared to what I was a year and a half ago, it's not even. And not only this, the skin tightens up. It's homefirst.com, HOMEFIRST.com, and we're actually developing a new website. And if you click on the metabolic clinic, or I got some pictures on the old website, or if you put homefirst.com/HCG, you'll see our new HCG website with even more information on HCG. If I want to tell you that New You magazine is one for plastic surgeons. They promised to be on the cover, and I got the issue this month, and I got to send you a cover if you haven't a copy. And I look at the cover, this absolutely gorgeous plastic surgery enhanced woman on it. I called the editor. I said, "Wait a minute, I'm not on the cover. You told me I was going to be." In the corner, it says, "Doctor loses 100 pounds on HCG."
Oh, well, let's not. Well, how's this? We'll take it to that next week. Hey, Mayor, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, my dear friend.
Yes.
And happy, healthy end of Pesach.
Yeah, and you too. Okay,
thank
take
you.
Care. I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you've adored for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Take it back now. Dr. Mark Hoffman, MD, with us. He is the author of Living Love Letters Beyond Time and Space. It's his first book. He's a physician who's had the unique opportunity to have close relationships with the Wyandot Indian Nation, the Maori tribe and from New Zealand, and the lineage holders of the Sakya and Drukpa Tibetan traditions. And let us say, Mark, I welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we cut through this, and when you take a look at the different places from the Indian Nation, and you go to the Tibetan traditions, is there an overarching theme? Is there an overarching something that there is a lesson for all of us that's underneath all of these different traditions?
Absolutely. The lesson here, and this is what I've been able to appreciate from spending time with all of these precious indigenous teachers, is that we are not our minds and we are not our bodies, but we are so much more. And that through the course of our life, we've been directed from birth outward. We're told everything we need is out there. And that's the lie that's been perpetrated. So we're angry. All of that negative emotion that's trapped within these minds, that, you know, this radio program, no pun intended, running in our heads 24/7, needs to be silenced. And that silence comes from the realization, the awareness, that we are the love that we're seeking, that everything that we need, we came into this life with. but we have to drop the mind, drop the story, get quiet, and manifest the heart.
So what
we are the lover that we're seeking, that our hearts are one.
Okay, but what you say, it's internal. And the big problem is that we've been looking for what we've been searching for outside of ourselves.
Exactly. From the moment of birth, we're directed outward. And we're told what we need is out there, and we got to go find it. And the actual message is that when you came into this life, your indwelling spirit, that spirit which your body supports so lovingly, that spirit which is dominated by that heart exists here and now within you. And that all you have to do is begin to go inside. And how do you go inside? Every moment of your life is a teaching. In this book, I share with you 50 years of spontaneously arising awarenesses. Those awarenesses, that's the journey from the mind going back inside to the heart, the experiences of the death of a child, the experiences of the intimacy of love, and then the realization that you are that love. You know, your body is your greatest lover because your body supports that which you are. In every moment, your body never rests. Your body is constantly attempting to give you unconditional love.
Well, let me hold
you. You begin to realize that you are filled with this lovingness that's overwhelming.
Okay, let me go underneath what you've said, and then let me tell you what I've heard. That, and you as a medical doctor, I'm sure you've seen it time and again. Some of the physical problems that we have, we've brought on ourselves, whether it's going to be cancer, whether it's going to be heart trouble, whether it's going to be any of it, and it's all standing up in defense of allowing us to see who we are, and it's the stress of that, the attacks of the immune system, and allows us to get sick. So what I'm hearing you say, if you look internally and you calm it down, that's the best medicine you can have for your immune system, and you allow yourself to experience the things that you won't allow yourself to experience.
Exactly. In other words, your mind lives in constant fear that you're going to recognize that it's the source of all that negativity. Negativity can manifest itself by weakening the immune system. It can manifest itself in a progression that becomes cancer, because the flow of energy is critical, and that energy is flowing from the center outward. So if you're inhabiting your mind, if you're stuck in your head, and this is the problem from birth, you've been told, worship the mind, you have been completely blocked. And it's only through dropping that mind, recognizing that the mind is fearful, that you will abandon it for your loving heart. Your heart is fearless love. The minute you drop into your body, you're relaxed. Everything that you feel and become is love. You're flowing with existence. You are now connected to everything. It's only when you're in your head that you're disconnected.
Now, by the way, there was about 13, 14 years ago that I had a debilitating disease. And I was told basically I had a year, year and a half to live. And I knew I had to get an operation. This is 13, 14 years ago, so we're still here. I knew that if I had to get an operation a month away, that I had to get in the best physical shape I could possibly get into to make it go better. So I'm sitting in the garage one day, and I'm on this exercise cycle, and I'm sweating, and I'm just doing it. And then all of a sudden, Mark, it hit me. I made it okay to die. Didn't say I want to die. I made it okay to die. The minute I made it okay to die, the pressure came off, the tension came off, and we're talking today.
Exactly. That's the realization. That's one of the realizations. Once the mind is where the fear exists, the minute you drop that fear, all right, your body is doing one thing from birth. It is marching towards death. Now, you have a choice to make. You can choose your heart over your mind. You can choose love over fear. And you can live right here, right now. Your body is going to die. There's no doubt about it. You are not your body. You are not your mind. This book is about that awareness, that realization. in that moment, you're at peace. Death will come, and when it comes, so be it. But you are not dying. Your body may die, all right? You're not attached to your body, and you're not attached to the negativity running around in your head. Your mind is a tombstone written upon by someone other than you. And that's where the anger comes from. That's where the negativity comes from, that you've been lied to, that you've been told everything is out there. What I am saying is the lover you seek is the lover you are. Your hearts are one. That heart is the divine within you. You are the manifestation of that love. Then time ceases. When you drop into your body, what you told me, Michael, is you dropped your mind. You dropped the fear. You let go. You surrendered. I'm saying, why do we surrender to the mind? Let's surrender to our hearts and be here now. Let's live while our body is capable of supporting us.
And by the way, Mark, I think the problem that most of us have is simply this. We don't know that.
Of course. If we knew it, we'd all be right here, right now. There'd be no negativity. There'd be no war. We would be abundant in everything we do, and we would be at peace.
Yeah,
and that's why. That's why, you know, we're suffering, because we don't know.
Well, that's exactly what it is, and I really believe there's something else. Most of us, you know, they're trying to find love, and you're right, it's inside of you. Most people say, I want to recapture it. You can never recapture something that you already have. It gets buried. It gets buried through a relationship. It gets buried through a rejection. It gets buried for something, but it's always there. And the key is to be able to open the door to see that it's always there. And we have been trained and taught to look externally for everything. And it doesn't happen externally. It happens inside. You get it together inside, and then everything that's outside you can handle. There may be things in your life that come up that you don't like. Somebody walks up and they smack you right in the nose. Now, you don't like it, and you couldn't control getting hit in the nose, but you can control how you feel about it, and that's the essence of what it's like when you're in control of your life. The biggest problem that most people have is they don't know how to relate to love. They don't know what this elusive thing is, and if you don't have a symbol for it, when it gets in front of you, you don't recognize it. And I think that's really what this is about. When you begin to realize it's not where you've been looking, because you'll never find it there, and you have the right place to look, then once you recognize it, then it's always there.
Exactly. You see, no one can love you the way you can love yourself, nor can you love until you love yourself. So, Michael, because you love yourself, you love me. I love myself, therefore I love you who loves yourself, who loves me, who love myself. Until you fall in love with yourself, you cannot be effective. You cannot love another human being. You talk about love, you should be embarrassed. In other words, I'm embarrassed the way I used to speak about love. Who's going to give me love? The lover, my greatest lover, became my greatest enemy. That's not love at all. So first, you have to be alone. Then you have to be alone with yourself. And then you have to be. And then you become that love. And then everything you are, everything you touch, all of life is just that love. And others will come to sit by your side. They will feel your heart. You'll be on an elevator. You'll be at the grocery checkout line. Every human heart wants to connect. And every heart recognizes that, that supersedes the mind. The heart is all powerful. The mind is merely an illusion. We've empowered the mind. So what I say is, Michael, plant the garden in your heart. Let your heart seed the mind, and then the entire world will blossom.
But there's something that you have to be careful of. When you begin to truly love yourself, the people who do not know how to love themselves are not going to like you. And that's going to happen until
they...
And that's the key. And I think that's the biggest challenge for most people. People who like themselves like other people who like themselves. And there's that draw, that magnetism that you're talking about. people who don't like themselves don't like people who like themselves, and you can feel it on an elevator, you can feel it in a crowd. So the challenge is, realize that if somebody doesn't like you, it's got nothing to do with you, it's got to do with them, and there's nothing you're going to do about it, so go about your business and you'll love yourself.
Exactly. I mean, I tell you, I feel like I'm talking to myself, you know, I'm looking in the mirror listening to you. That's absolutely what it is. But in that moment, when you realize that you are the love, the ego disappears. It doesn't matter what someone else says. You have compassion now, because that self-lovingness manifests itself as compassion. So you're no longer reactive. The mind is reactive. I don't like you. You look funny. But in that space, the space that you now have inhabited, your body, your heart, you're compassionate. You understand that's them, that they're upset, that they're unhappy, and you're able to be patient. All the enlightened beings simply sit with us, aware that we are suffering, and that suffering is illusion, waiting for us to recognize, drop in, you're the heart, you are the love, and that's it. That's the whole thing.
Mark, there's so many people frightened to death of death. How's that? They're frightened of death, but you die every day. Every time you learn something, something old dies off within you. So you go through this process constantly, and it's a growing process. Dying is growing. And I really believe that if you get an understanding of it, now, when the physical death comes, everybody's going to be a little frightened of that. Why? Because it's the quote-unquote unknown. You hear things, but you'll never know until you step across that line. But we die constantly. Get into a relationship, it doesn't work. Something in you, not the relationship, something in you, if you move forward, dies off and you live a little more, you grow a little more, you become a little bigger, and then you move on in life. You lose a job. The biggest problem that you had is you didn't want the thing in the first place if you lost it. And when you take the responsibility of the action, you grow some more. And then you get pretty big down the road. Only if you want to be and you realize that life is all about lessons. And once you've learned the lesson that keeps getting thrown in your face, guess what the prize is? Another lesson.
Exactly. That's the beauty of it all. The only constant is change.
Yeah.
In the mind, we exist in a state of fear. We're attached. We're attached to everything. When you drop the mind, you free yourself from that prison. Suddenly, you realize that all you want to do is be flowing with existence.
Yeah.
If there were no change, then we'd all be dead right now. And that's the point that you have to understand. To be alive, you have to constantly go through birth and death. I wake up, the sun shines. I go to sleep, I close my eyes, I'm not there. The next morning, I wake up again. Birth, death, rebirth, in every moment.
Yeah, absolutely, no question about it. We are starting to run out of time, so let me ask you this. Mark, is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Well, yeah, if you go to drmarklovingness-shop.com, it'll connect you. You can go to the book. You can Google Books and read inside the book, purchase the book. You can go to, it'll take you to the Facebook page, facebook.com/lovingness, all in caps, where there are more awarenesses that I'm writing. People are coming from all over the world, sharing, expressing. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to, put my heart out there and be received so beautifully. So thank you so much.
Hey, Mark Hoffman, thank you so much for being here. And take care and keep it up.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
World for a toll. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
more time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Well, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening. Thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Robert Webster with us has often been called the crown jewel of London's legal society. It's Barrister Robert Webster, and a barrister is a member of the two classes of lawyers found in many common law jurisdictions with split legal professions. And he's successfully combined his practice at the bar with a career in the academic world, which began with his appointment to London Inns Court School, the School of Law, now the City of the City Law School, the country's leading vocational school for aspirant barristers. He has subsequently directed and developed international study programs and curricula for McGeorge School of Law. That's in California. And let us say, Robert, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, greetings. Good evening. How are you?
Oh, I am good. And thank you so much for being here. We're going to talk about the royal wedding. And I think a very interesting thing is going to occur. Robert, the cultures have changed. The cultures have changed in England. The cultures have changed here. And those two youngsters are a part of a culture that wasn't the traditional culture of England. I mean, yes, William is. But at the same time, he's still a young man, and he's exposed to what the world is like for a young man. The marriage of the two of them, is it going to change the hierarchy of England once those two get in and they become king and queen?
Oh, Michael, I think it's a great observation and great question you've asked. I think let's start with this. I think it's enormously interesting to actually see the sort of reception that this engagement and this forthcoming marriage have been given by the general public. I think for monarchists amongst us, it's enormously reassuring. For this reason, there's absolutely no doubt at all that the monarchy simply can't survive without the respect and support and indeed affection of the people. And I can come back to that a little bit later. But in respect of the changing culture, here you have two new dynamic royals, if you like. The culture's moved on phenomenally and significantly since the marriage of Charles to Diana Spencer. Here we have Prince William, who's not chosen to go to Oxford or Cambridge, but chosen to go to St. Andrews University. And lo and behold, he has a regular college romance of the sort that's shared by countless people across the globe. And what's interesting is that he's chosen for his partner, and I think he's made his own choice here, and that's enormously important too, and something I can revert to in a second. But he's chosen for his partner a girl who's been dismissively described as a commoner. I mean, if you look at her social status strictly, that's who she is. Her parents worked for British Airways. Her mother was an air stewardess. Her father was a flight dispatcher. But as a result of their dint of industry and diligence, I mean, they've established a business which has been phenomenally successful and have concentrated their efforts on their children and opened up a world of opportunities to them, including, of course, an opportunity to meet a prince at St. Andrews University. But I think what's important about the engagement and the forthcoming marriage in terms of the changing culture as follows. One is, as I mentioned earlier, Michael, Catherine Middleton is not from the fading grandeur of European royal palaces. She's not from the rolling green estates of the British, in some cases, beleaguered aristocracy, certainly beleaguered financially. She's a solidly middle-class girl who strikes me as enormously sensible and enormously mature. And so when we look at the royal family, I think we want to be able to say as a nation who we are. The royal family, the monarchy in particular, helps to identify us. And many people can look at this monarchy now and see that in a couple of generations, we're going to have a king who is married to an ordinary gal who's parents did very well, but nevertheless, an ordinary gal, and that makes the monarchy more relevant, I think. And I think this mirrors a trend, by the way, across Europe. If you look at the crown princes of Denmark and Norway and Spain, these chaps have all married what we so awfully call commoners. But nobody is predicting the accelerated destruction of the monarchy in any of those countries. And I think that Catherine Middleton is going to add an abundance of common sense to the institution and is going to be enormously popular. And Michael, don't forget also, these two young folk have known one another for a great deal of time. I mean, it's going on now nearly eight years, nearly 9 years. And so their relationship has clearly reached a level of maturity. And as you look at these two, I mean, they're enormously at ease with one another. And that's a very sharp contrast to the situation that his father dealt with when he married Diana Spencer, where essentially they had to go and look for a bride from a suitable background when Prince Charles got married. This is not the case now. You don't have royal courtiers or officials meddling or pursuing some sort of meddlesome policy in trying to find a royal bride. Here's William demonstrating that he's his own man, and I'm sure she's her own woman too. And I think these two represent a great deal of hope for the monarchy. So, yes, changing culture in all sorts of ways, and I think they represent, as I say, the hopes of all who believe in the monarchy, which I think lends to our political and social stability.
Robert, I think what's going to happen here, that you've got a historic identity, and that historic identity has guidelines to live by. You know, you would have somebody who is not her, somebody, let's say, that came from royalty. They know how to be a royal wife, a royal this, a royal that. They've got somebody who's, quote unquote, the commoner coming in. Now, she looks like a wonderful young woman, and her heart is, I'm sure, in the right place, and I'm not just saying that. You could feel her. So
yeah.
You know, he's got a choice. But what's going to happen, it's the dilution of the identity of the English throne that's going to occur over a period of time. In maybe 5, 10, 15 years to come, it won't be what it once was, because truly it's not only a process, but it's a mindset. And when the mindset changes, everything else changes.
You see, I think you make an enormously important point there, talking of the dilution of the monarchy. There's no doubt at all that we're going to have, I think, a more informal monarchy, that's for sure. And also, I think another point that's relevant to your own observations there, Michael, is the following. I think it's enormously important that the monarchy retains some mystical degree of luster and magic.
Yes.
It has to be something beyond glamour. And because if it's not, you know, the monarchy is going to be reduced and diluted, as you say, but reduced to celebrity status. And I think we've seen that erosion already take place. I think because of the scandals that have beset the royal family over the last 20 years, three out of the Queen's four children's marriages failing, that sort of thing, that the royal family has lost its mystique, it has lost its magic, and it's treated, members of the royal family today are treated sort of rather like celebrities. But I think you're right. I think it may well be that, you know, that royal network within which the royal houses married, particularly up to the 1920s and 1930s, that's gone, and we're entering a new, and to a large extent, Michael, unknown era, I think.
Now, by the way, Robert, one of the things that concerns me, and obviously I'm not a Brit, but what concerns me is this. I remember, when was it, a month or two ago, there were rocks thrown at his car. Remember
yes.
that? Yes, okay. This would never have happened 15, 20, 25 years ago. So there's an element of respect that's going. the England opened up its doors, and there were a lot of people that were not English that came in, and there was an effect, and it was an effect that caused a change in the way that England looked at itself. Now, I've noticed also lately that people are starting to stand up and say, we want what we want, and this is who we are, and if you don't like it, don't stay in my country, quote unquote. I won't take that any farther. But the key is there is also a dilution of the respect for the monarchy that's starting to go on. When you've got the commoners, the ordinary people, throwing rocks at the car when you've got a prince in the car.
Yes, this is an absolutely tragic situation, and I think it's one that I watched with increasing alarm. And as you say, 20, 30 years ago would simply never have occurred. I think one of the problems, Michael, of the age we live in, particularly in the United Kingdom, is we've become a very, very divided nation. And I think we're a nation in search of an identity, quite frankly. I'm not entirely sure if we're really comfortable with who we are. The one thing the monarchy does, it kind of reassures us of who we are. It certainly reassures us about who we were. And with this young couple getting married, I think it tells us who we're going to be. But there's that interim period of unease in between, because there's absolutely no doubt, grave concerns about immigration as a result of, for example, our membership of the European Union. We are obliged to accept fellow citizens, immigrants from the other 26 member states. We're obliged to do that by virtue of the treaties that we've signed. Additionally, we have welcomed immigration from much further afield in respect of those who are seeking a different quality of life or a better quality of life and trying to escape persecution. But as a result of the economic woes, I really extremely serious economic woes that we're facing, inevitably people are turning to immigrants and blaming them for sort of taking the bread out of their mouths. And I think we're a less deferential society, Michael, that's for sure. I think that's rather sad, because, you know, I think mutual respect is an immensely important factor or hallmark that should characterize good civil society.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I have felt, Robert, for many years, like the United States, America is one of the most powerful, it is the most powerful country in the world. Toe to toe, you don't stand up to us. But if you want us, you cause us to implode. You divide us. It's what's going on. I'm watching, you know, and that's what's going on in England right now. The big problem, as I see it, I'm listening to you talk, it's the who you are is starting to be diluted for people who don't live there, did not grow up with the culture, are saying this is who you should be. And there's where the problem lies.
Yes, I think so. I think that the problem lies there. I think you're absolutely right, certainly partly. And it's attributable to a failure on the part of successive governments to manage policies that are protective of the nation. And I think while we should honor our obligations and undertakings under international law in respect of our membership of the European Union, I think we need to be able to formulate humane and compassionate but reasonable policies, for example, with regard to immigration, that are sensible and practical and that the people understand. And at the moment, people just do not understand. And of course, the other problem is this. I think we've become a less deferential society. There's absolutely no doubt about that. That doesn't simply apply to the monarchy. It applies to government in particular, or to politicians, rather, in general. In the last few months now, we've dispatched four or five hitherto honorable members of parliament to prison because they've been fiddling their expenses. I mean, a heck of a lot of them have all been fiddling their expenses. But lo and behold, with the sufficiently egregious evidence of a number of them doing this, and breaching the public trust in this dramatic and catastrophic manner, earning a prison sentence, and quite lengthy prison sentences too, and quite rightly in my view. But that clearly doesn't earn the affection of the voters. And when the nation picks up its tabloid newspapers or the broadsheets or tunes into the internet and sees what's going on, it loses faith. And it loses faith in an enormously important institution, Parliament. And there's no doubt that we're seeing the effects of this loss of faith currently. And to some extent, we then look to the monarchy. And what is it? Is it a justifiable system? Well, it lacks legitimacy to a very large extent, because, you know, there you end up being the head of state simply by accident of birth. And so the monarchy occupies a space in society that in other circumstances, Michael, certainly as far as our country is concerned, would be occupied by a politician. A politician who perhaps would be past his sell-by date and is given this sinecure as head of state, as president. And we've shown no appetite for that at all. The monarchy represents something of a rallying point. We saw that in the Second World War. There's absolutely no doubt at all that George VI's leadership earned the affection of the nation and the admiration. And of course, it's interesting when you... I went to see the King's speech a few weeks ago, and I don't know if you've seen it, Michael.
No, I haven't seen it yet.
And it was encouraging and rather touching that the audience applauded at the end of the movie. And of course, during the Second World War, audiences applauded when they saw newsreel film in the cinemas, in the theaters, when the King was speaking, because they looked to him for leadership. They looked to him to do some good. And I believe that's what's going to be expected of this terrific, I think rather dynamic young couple. I think people will be enormously supportive as long as they see these two doing good for others and providing some sort of role model and providing leadership. And here you have this clearly enormously impressive young man who's obviously very down to earth and clearly very comfortable in his own skin. Here he is pursuing a regular job as a search and rescue helicopter pilot.
Robert, let me hold you up for a minute because we're starting to run out of time, but I want to give you some feedback on this. Oh, no, that's okay. No, I'm not. You could be on all night as far as I'm concerned. I'm in a time problem, but I want to give you some feedback from what I've listened very closely to what you've said. England and America have one major problem. What we have lost is commonality of definition. There are too many people here who think completely different. You can't get everybody together moving in one track the same way. Now, as far as the hierarchy is concerned, the traditional way it has been with king, queen, etc., you see, it should stay there symbolically, because as long as that symbolic feel is there, mom and dad are still there, because the king and queen have always been mom and dad. They do not have to be politicians, but it's the symbolic nature of knowing that deep down, the hundreds of years, the thousand years, whatever it is, there has been that safety net that you know that they're there and they're there for you. And I really believe joining the European Union, the rest of it, nobody asks this question. What does it mean when I join? Where's my commonality of definition? If I join, does that mean I have to do this? And in the end result, I am deluded as a citizen of a particular country. We don't ask those questions. And I think we should know those things going in. If we expect it going in, we know what to do to shore up the weak spots. But in effect, it's the division that's causing it. And I hope that young man is strong enough to keep it together.
I agree entirely, Michael. It's my own thought too. It's interesting, by the way, that when Prince Charles says that when he comes to be crowned, and presuming he does come to be crowned, that that the monarch is the supreme governor of the Church of England and is known as the defender of the faith. That's the established Church of England. And given the multicultural nature of British society, Prince Charles says he wants to be crowned as defender of all faiths, reflecting, of course, how changed things have become. We don't know if that's going to be acceptable or not, but we're grappling with a multiplicity of social, economic, and political issues. Sure. And I think on the big day next week, we'll have a major distraction of pomp and circumstance, which will be enormously uplifting, because whatever our problems, we do pageantry really well.
Oh, and I've got you loud and clear. And by the way, Robert, thank you so much. Now, is there a website we can find you at?
Unfortunately, no. I should have been born in the age of the quill pen, Michael. So I go to construct it. I've been encouraged in the last few weeks to get a website. So it will be under construction in the next wee while, I hope.
Oh, and by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and thank you for the information, because if we stay together and if we just, quote-unquote, keep the faith, and I don't mean religious faith, the faith in ourselves, the faith in our countries, that's what I think is going to pull us through this whole thing. And thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, it's been a great pleasure. I've enjoyed it enormously. Many, many thanks for great observations. And it's been a real treat and privilege to be on your show. Many, many thanks indeed, not only for hosting me, but also for all your great broadcasting.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night now. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. And as a matter of fact, if you like what you hear, go tell all your friends about it. That's the way we grow. That's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.